Hey everybody, it's Pastor Brian Ross from Grace Life Bible Church in Grand Rapids, Michigan. We want to welcome you this morning to our midweek video. We appreciate you tuning in as always. If you haven't already done so, if you would consider subscribing and ringing the alarm bell as a way of staying current with the ministry, both when we go live from our assembly building on Sunday morning, as well as when we create content for you here midweek, we would certainly appreciate that. Our featured book this week is my co-authored book, Church History Book, on J.C. O'Hare and the Origins of the American Grace Movement. I wrote this book with Dr. Dale DeWitt, former college professor of mine, and it was published in 2018. It's nearly 300 pages. This is a true church history book, and if you are interested in knowing the history of the American Grace Movement, please consider picking up a copy of J.C. O'Hare and the Origins of the American Grace Movement. As a way of supporting the ministry, we would certainly appreciate that. Also want to remind you about our Rumble channel here, Grace Life Bible Church on Rumble. We established this as an alt-text site. Should something happen to our YouTube ministry, so if you're into alt-text sites or would just like an alternative to YouTube, please consider checking us out here on Rumble as well. So last week I did a video here from my office on did the King James translators view their work as perfect, false friends, and prefaces in the AV. And that was a long video. That video was over an hour. I typically don't like to make the videos that long, but I didn't see any way around it, especially once I got started with it, because I didn't want to end it before I had the ability to kind of close off my thoughts, knowing that I could circle back behind this video and kind of go a little bit slower and possibly explain things in a little bit more detail or try to flush out some more things related to what I was covering here. In later videos. And that's kind of what I want to do in this video and maybe a couple more, just to kind of make sure that there's a little bit more depth here. I had to kind of go fast through some stuff in the video from last week. The video from last week was born out of lesson 191 from This Generation Forever class, where I was began talking about the preliminary contents to the 1611, to the AV of 1611, and I was talking in 191 about the title page in the Epistle Dedicatory, and it was there that I noticed a couple items that I wanted to talk about further or in more detail here in this video from last week. So what I want to do in this video that I'm making now is just kind of talk a little bit further about a few of the things. Now, I don't want to test your patience and repeat everything, but I do want to, and I want to add some stuff to this video that I didn't cover in the last video related to this language here in the preface that we were discussing in the last video. Okay. So again, this is paragraph 4 of the Epistle Dedicatory. And I talked to you about the essay from Burridge and how Burridge says that the Epistle Dedicatory and the Translators to the Reader written by Miles Smith need to go together or work in conjunction with each other to get the full picture and understanding of what they thought they were doing, what they were accomplishing, the means or ways in which they were accomplishing it, etc. And so we were focusing here on this. And it jumped. There's a line here that jumped off the page at me when I was preparing for lesson 191 over here, where I'm like, okay, I have to go look up the word exact in 17th century, 16th and 17th century English language resources to figure out what the word exact meant at the time the translation was being done, all right? And again, that is born largely out of, number one, my own conclusion that readers of the AV are reading a Bible that is admittedly more than 400 years old, and there are words in the AV that maybe need that the def not maybe that definitely need to be looked up by the and try to be ascertained what they meant by the standards of the time, and I had come to that conclusion, and you can look at a whole lot of material that I've produced over the years where I talk about those things well before I ever even read Brother Mark Ward's book Authorized: The Use and Misuse of the King James Bible. But I did think that exact was potentially what Brother Ward would call a false friend. Okay, and again, going off my notes here, and we covered this in the last video, how does he define a false friend, right? He defines a false friend that it's a word in the King James that we still use, so we still use exact, a word we use differently from the Elizabethans, and thirdly, the difference escapes the reader of today. So when I saw the word exact there in the Epistle Dedicatory, I'm like, I got to look this up because I suspect that whoever authored the Epistle Dedicatory was potentially using a meaning of the word exact that we don't necessarily use today. Okay, so here is the paragraph. There are infinite arguments of this right Christian and religious affection in your majesty, but none is more forcible to declare it to others than the vehement and perpetuated desire of accomplishing and publishing of this work. Okay, so what is he talking about? He's talking about this work right here, the 1611, right? Which now, with all humility, we present to your majesty. So the Epistle Dedicatory is presenting the volume to the king. For when your highness had once, out of deep judgment, apprehended how convenient it was that out of the original sacred tongues, together with comparing of the labors, both in our own and other foreign languages, of many worthy men who went before us, that there should be one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue, your majesty did never desist to urge and to excite those to whom it was commended, that the work might be hastened and the business might be expedited in so decent a manner as a matter of such importance might justly require. So I presented in my video from last week here an argument for why this is talking about the 1611, particularly the statement that there should be one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures. Okay, we went to Barlow, Sum and Substance, the notes on the Hampton Court Conference. And we saw that when John Reynolds of the Puritan delegation first floated the idea of there being a new Bible, James responded and said that he had not yet seen a Bible well translated into English, and that he thought the church needed one principal one, or one volume for church use. And so he approves Reynolds' idea on that project. Okay. So James said that he had never yet seen the Bible well translated into English way back at Hampton Court in 1604. Then the rules are set up by Bancroft. Rule 1, to follow the bishop's Bible, unless the truth of the original said otherwise. And Rule 14, if the bishop's Bible was viewed as not being adequate or accurate or exact, dare I say, then it listed out what other English translations they were to consult as they worked on their project. Okay, so why bother doing all of this if what the outcome that is being presented to the king is not going to have the quality of being more exact, being one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures in the English tongue? So, in other words, James himself, the whole reason this is happening is because James does not believe, or did not believe, that he had yet seen the Bible well translated into English. So the outcome of this 7-year plus odyssey that the translators have been on has been to produce something that was viewed as more exact than what came before. That seems to me to be totally obvious in the context of this paragraph from what is going on. Okay. Now, the word exact. When I first thought, wow, I need to look that word up, I know of the existence of the table alphabetical. The table alphabetical was done by Robert Cowdery, and it was done in 1604. All right. So again, here's the title page from the table alphabetical. This is from 1604. It was done at London, and this is a table of hard words. Here it is. Let's read it. A table alphabetical containing and teaching the true writing and understanding of hard, unusual English words borrowed from Hebrew, Greek, Latin, and French. So that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to set forth, okay, not only how to write them, but also how to understand their meaning. This is arguably the first English dictionary ever published. at 1604 in London. 1604 is the same year as the Hampton Court Conference where James authorized the translation of the Bible and set the project in motion, all right, for there to be a new Bible in English, all right? Now, if we come home, so I wanted to look up the word exact. So we come in here to page 70, and I'm going to scroll down here, and we can see an entry for exact, and notice how exact is defined. Perfectly done. So the Epistle Dedicatory talks about that there should be one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures in English. We come now to an early 17th century English language resource designed to tell us what English words meant at the time, contemporaneous with the translators, and we find that exact means perfectly done according to the table alphabetical. Okay. Now, what I have observed so far as a response to my video from last week, is basically two responses, all right? One of them is a doubling down on old thinking relative to the Epistle Dedicatory and the preface that does not take into account exact as a so-called false friend, okay? And all of that writing, whether it was by Kudelik or Norris that I saw, did not even acknowledge the fundamental premise of what I was attempting to assert in the video, okay? And that is that there's a false friend here, and that false friend meant perfectly done by standards of the day. So that was one response. The other response was a refusal, seemingly, to acknowledge that words can have more than one meaning. The idea was, well, exact means exact, and perfect means perfect, and that's just the way it is. And that was a sort of a second response. And I don't really understand that response either, because there's obviously synonyms, and that's the way language works. The translators themselves said that they did not, you know, stand curiously on a uniformity of phrasing or an identity of words. So obviously they approved of the use of synonyms in doing their mix. Sorry, doing their translation. I don't know why I said mix. Weird. Anyway, I do weird stuff. Sorry about that. So those have been basically the two responses. Now, once I saw exact here, I'm like, okay, well, we need to go look at the OED. So I went to the OED. Here's the entry for the adjective exact. Okay. And here is the first thing that I saw. Look at it. So here's exact. So let's take stock. Exact, perfectly done. Okay. We come to the adjective exact. Number one, perfected, consummate, finished. Number one, of qualities, conditions, attainments, consummate, finished, refined, perfect. Rarely in a bad sense, obsolete. So the OED says that there is an obsolete meaning of the adjective exact that is related to perfect. That is exactly what the table alphabetical says. Exact, perfectly done. So a English language resource by the standard of the early 17th century says exact meant perfectly done. The OED identifies an obsolete meaning of exact that's related to perfect. Now that's objectively the case. All right. So then we can come up here and look at the etymology. Latin exactus. So exact is coming out of English from Latin. All right. The Latin adjective has the senses, number one, highly finished, consummate, from the verb in the sense to complete, bring to perfection, and accurate, precise. So exact is coming from the word the Latin exactus into English and is related to the idea of being to bring to perfection, which is exactly what this says, perfectly done from the table alphabetical. So my position that I was trying to enunciate in the last video is that the table alphabetical, is that the epistle dedicatory has not been accurately understood, because modern readers of the epistle dedicatory come to this paragraph here, this one right here, and they see exact and they ascribe to exact modern meaning and usage, not the meaning and usage that was available and in use to the folks at the time the translation was done, that we can prove from the table alphabetical and that the OED is confirming. Okay? Then we can go to the lexicons of early modern English. This is an amazing website that if you are into this type of research, I think you'll feel is indispensable. It's free. You can search any word and it will pull this up. So if we come to the lexicons of early modern English, and I've already done this, you can see we're searching here for the word exact. And I've done a control F here, and I've also searched now this, I've searched the search, if you will, for occurrences of perfect related to exact. Okay? So the first occurrence here, notice, of exact is from 1527. Right? Now, if we go here and we track with the searchable ones, let's come down here. And the first one that we find, it skipped one by accident, sorry about that, again, is the Bibliotheca, and I don't know how to pronounce that, by Thomas Eliot from 1542, and notice exactus, okay? Now, where did we see exactus? We saw exactus right here from the etymology in the OED that the English exact is coming from exactus, and we saw that it is related to bringing to perfection. Now we have an entry in the lexicons of modern early English from 1542 for exactus, and notice what it says. Past, very diligent, exact, notice, perfectly done or performed. Now what is the entry in the table alphabetical telling us exact meant perfectly done? So here we see the lexicons of early modern English adding yet another layer of evidence. And it's taking and it's showing us that by 1542, the Latin exactus is related to exact and perfectly done. The same thing that we're seeing by the OED in the obsolete definition, and the same thing that we can see when we look at the table alphabetical. All right. Let's look at a few more. Here again, this is from 1587. Exactus, exact, perfectly done. Or sought with great diligence. So here's another English language resource from 1587 connecting the Latin exactus with the idea of being perfectly done. Okay. Here we have exquisitus, fine, perfect, exact. So in the definition for this Latin word, again, they are tied to each other. Okay. We can see this over and over again as we look at the lexicons of early modern English. Here is the English schoolmaster that I talked about in the video from last week. Here again, this is from 1598. We can see exact, again, tied to perfect. Here's John Florio's, okay, A World of Words. Again, we can see again, I'm not sure exactly what language this is from, but perfect and exact, complete, tied together, all right? Here's the English schoolmaster. We got that. We got John Florio. Here's the table alphabetical again. Exact, perfectly done. That's the same thing that we saw here. Let's go beyond 1611. Signification of words, 1604. Here's another connection of exact or perfect being made in a resource. Exquisitus. Exact, excellent, perfect. This goes on and on and on of things that are tying these words together here in the late 16th century and early 17th century. Here's the table alphabetical edition from 1613. Again, exact, perfectly done. We get beyond this point. Here's an entry for exact in a an English expositor from 1616 exact, to demand with great earnestness or with constraint. Also, it signifieth perfect and accomplished. Perfect signifieth perfect. Okay? Exact, perfect, again, 1617. We it's starting to sound like a broken record here. Exact, perfect. Here's a table alphabetical from 1617. Exact, perfectly done. We can go beyond this. Here's exact from 1621, the English expositor. Again, exact, signifying perfect. And so there is clearly a meaning related to exact that is of exact that is tied to perfect. This is true in Latin, and this is true in late 16th century, early 17th century England. Here's an English expositor, 1614, exact, again, signifying perfect. 1657, perfection. There's an entry for perfection, and a complete, accomplished, absolute, rare, divine, exact. So there's perfection tied with exact again from 1657. And we can see the same thing here, exact from 1668, exact, adjective, perfect, okay? So the case is overwhelming, but there is obviously in late 16th century, early 17th century England, a use and meaning of exact that is tied to the idea of something being perfectly done. The OED confirms this and marks this obsolete, and a host of other examples we could look at here now in the lexicons of early modern English also bear this out, okay? And we haven't even looked at all 35 of them. The list goes on and on and on as you look at this. What is this? This is from the New Dictionary, 1735, exact, perfect. So when they say in the Epistle Dedicatory, there should be one more exact translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue, one more perfectly done translation of the Holy Scriptures into the English tongue. Like, and this one that they're doing, that they're dedicating to the king's and accrediting here to his deep judgment and to the fact that he never desists to urge and to excite those to whom it was commended, clearly to me is demonstrating that they had this, that they knew what they were talking about here, and they were using the word exact in the sense of being perfect. Okay. Now, perfect, then. So let's go over here. And again, like I said, perfect, there is more than one meaning of perfect. I said this in the last video, and it is meaning 6b. That is the one that we want to look at here because it relates to what we're talking about. So here's entry 6. Look at B. Accurate, correct. That relates exactly with what we just looked at from the lexicons of early modern English and all those examples. Accurate, correct. Accurately reproducing and reflecting the original of a notion, thought, record, etc., accurately corresponding to the facts. So here again, the OED in defining perfect, 6B, is using exact to define perfect. Exactly corresponding to the facts, obsolete. So this is also marked obsolete. So is there a meaning of exact that is related to perfect in the lexicons of early modern English, in the OED, that is, so I have no problem then understanding that the translators of the King James did think their work was perfect in the sense of 6b, accurate, correct, accurately reproducing and reflecting the original. Okay. Now, I don't want this video to be too long, and I've got time to make another video, which I want to do, where I want to get more into this idea of perfect. But what I want to establish here, and notice that there's a 1611 meaning and usage from the preface, the translation was not so sound and so perfect, but that it needed correction in many places. Now, the context of that statement in the preface is in the context of the LXX, okay, of the Septuagint. It is certain that the translation, that translation, referring in the context to the LXX, the Septuagint, was not so sound and so perfect, but it needed in many places correction. So in other words, it wasn't exact. It wasn't perfectly done, and it needed correction. In the next video, I'm going to show you that the word perfect, which occurs seven times, I can show you that right now, the word perfect that occurs seven times in the preface or form of perfect is used in more than one way by Miles Smith when he wrote the Translators to the Reader, when he wrote the preface. But there is a meaning of perfect that is identified by the OED as occurring in the 1611 in a reference to the Septuagint, where it is not so sound and so perfect. It is not exact. It is not accurate. It is not correct. It is not accurately reproducing or reflecting the original. It is not exactly corresponding to the facts. Miles Smith said that, and the OED is saying that when he said that in that phrase, in that line of the preface, that he was using this obsolete definition of perfect, which is the definition that correlates back to what we've seen in the lexicons of early modern English, what we've seen in the OED, and what we've seen in the table alphabetical. Okay? So I think I'm going to sort of make another video where I come back to talk a little bit more about perfect here. But you need to understand that there's more than one sense of perfect. And the OED is clearly identifying that there is an obsolete sense and meaning of perfect that Miles Smith used in the preface to talk about the LXX. That it's not as accurate as it should be, not correct, not accurately reflecting or reproducing the original. So the King James translators, do they think that their work was exact? That it was perfectly done, that it was by the definitional, by the circumscribed boundaries of definition 6b, did they think that they had accurately stated in English what the original Hebrew and Greek, what the original language text had to say, that they had communicated it accurately, correctly, okay, reproducing and reflecting the original exactly corresponding to the facts, okay? They did do that. That is their position. Now, they are not saying, okay, they are not saying perfect, exact, in the sense of 1B, in a state of complete excellence free from any imperfection or defect or quality that cannot be improved upon, okay? Now, so what the translators have done is they staked out a position where they say that their work was exact. They acknowledge that they were not using verbatim identicality, that they were not using uniformity of phrasing. They acknowledge that there were some places where the text had some obscurity to it, where they weren't sure exactly, and so they identify those places in the margin. And they also obviously don't think that it could never be improved upon because later in the process, years after the translation, we have rumors that some of the translators oversaw some of the revisions that were taking place. And obviously the text went through orthographical changes, it went through punctuation changes, it went through spelling changes, okay? So they thought it was perfect and correct and exact in the sense of accuracy, 6B, not 1B. And this seems to me to be completely obvious when you just look at the facts of the case, right? And I want to end with one more thing, all right? So a friend of mine, researcher, Christopher Yetzer, fellow companion researcher, he sent me a few things to consider. This is from 1645, okay? And notice, an epigram upon the exact translation of the Psalms. And there's this little poem here about the Psalms, all right? Then we have this statement here. This is from 1655. And by the way, some of the English language resource examples that I gave from the lexicons of early modern English clearly cover and extend beyond the time period here of 1655. But notice this entry here. This is by John Wilkins, 1655. Notice, the Bishop's Bible, in the beginning of Queen Elizabeth's reign, by Archbishop Parker and others, which, because it was not so exact and carefully done, too often following the Greek rather than the Hebrew, and so liable to diverse mistakes, as many appear in the reading of the Psalms, okay, of the liturgy, therefore King James caused another most exact translation to be made in his time, which is by the way of distinction called the King James Bible. So here, notice what he says. He says it's the most exact. It's most exact. It is more exact than the bishops. So how then is the author of the Epistle Dedicatory thinking about this when they say this statement right here, that there should be one more exact translation? Here we have an author from 1655 who is ascribing to the King James the quality of greater exactness than the bishops. And notice, King James called for another most exact translation. Folks, the fact that the king had not stated that he had not yet seen the Bible well translated in English and said there needed to be another one demonstrates this. This is what the context of the fourth paragraph of the Epistle Dedicatory is saying. And then Richard Simon, the Roman Catholic opposition to the Puritan movement, Reformation movement, notice what he says, okay? Besides, the translators having left out of the margin the various interpretations of the equivocal words, whereof there are great and many in the Hebrew text, it is also most impossible that they should always choose the best, whereunto we may add that several persons being commended by King James to assist in the making of the translation, it was hard for them to keep that uniformity which is requisite in a work of this nature, and besides, they were obligated to follow certain rules which took from them the liberty of making an exact translation. So here's Richard Simon, the Roman Catholic opponent of Protestantism, ripping on the King James Bible and saying that it is not exact. It took from them the liberty of making an exact translation. So he's castigating and excoriating it. And by the way, this is written in the late 1600s. By saying that it is not an exact translation because they had to follow certain rules. So again, I submit to you, how is the word exact being used here in the 17th century to discuss the translation? Here's a Roman Catholic opponent of Protestantism ripping on the King James and saying that it's not as exact as it should be because they had to follow certain rules. And here's a Protestant in 1655 saying that it is another most exact translation to be made in his time, which is by distinction called the King James Bible. It's clear that exact had a meaning that is, it's clear that exact had a meaning, let's go back to the OED, that is now obsolete. Of the qualities, conditions, attainments, consummated, finished, refined, perfect. So, did the translators view their work as perfect? All right. My answer to that question is yes, they did view their work as perfect by the circumscribed boundaries of definition 6b. They thought their work was accurate, correct, accurately reproducing and reflecting the original of an ocean thought record, etc., exactly corresponding to the facts. They thought that their work accurately stated in English the contents of the original Hebrew and Greek, compared to the labors of prior English versions, they thought that the one that they were making had the quality of being more exact, and that is exactly what this resource is saying from 1655 by John Wilkins when you look at what it's, when you think about what it's saying. Now, in the next video in this little mini series, I suppose, I want to talk about the, particularly about the preface and the use of the word exact, sorry, the use of the word perfect, and look at the different meanings and occurrences of the word perfect in the preface. Anyway, I appreciate your attention on this video. If you are interested in learning more about these things, again, I would encourage you to consider checking out my class, From This Generation Forever, A Study of God's Promise to Preserve His Word. It's available in multiple different formats. Here is the blog spot that I created to house the material. You can also pick it up on the church's website in a different format here. All of the lessons have video, audio, and PDF notes. And I'm also rebroadcasting all of this on this channel, this YouTube channel, every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. The older original lessons, I'm trying to migrate those off of the YouTube page of a former Saint of Grace Life Bible Church who moved away, who helped me with these things way back when, before I understood how YouTube works. And so we're making a master playlist here. We continue to add to these and rebroadcast them here on this YouTube channel every Monday, Wednesday, Friday. Listen, if you've never trusted Jesus Christ, if you've never come to a place where you've acknowledged the fact that you cannot save yourself, that your bet, that your works, your performance, your religious activity will always leave you short of the glory of God, you need to reach out in faith to a Redeemer, the Lord Jesus Christ, who died on the cross for your sin, paid the price, shed his blood in payment for your sin, was buried, and rose again the third day. He was delivered for our offenses, and he was raised again for our justification. You need to trust the finished work of the Lord Jesus Christ today before it's everlasting too late. You need to understand that he died for you so that you would not have to suffer the second death. He died in your stead, in your place. He suffered and made, shed his blood and made satisfaction of the offended justice of God against sin so that he could give you and I eternal life as a free gift. Trust and believe today that Christ died on the cross for your sin, was buried, and rose again. You'll pass from death to life. You'll be taken out from under the power of darkness and translated into the kingdom of his dear Son. Trust Christ today before it's everlasting too late. Thanks for your attention, and we'll see you next time.